Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoSillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, November 20th, 2016, and this is show number 602. Well, before we get started, we have a quick public service announcement from Steve to start us off.
Hi, NoSilla Castaways. Steve here with an update on upcoming plans. There will not be a live NoSillaCast show on Sunday, November 27th because of a special event on that day. Good friend of the show, Shai Yamani, is performing as the character Sam in the musical Mamma Mia at the Segerstrom Hall in Costa Mesa, California. Allison, I, and a few NoSilla castaways will be attending the matinee performance on the 27th and are thrilled to be able to connect with Shai again after the show. If you live in the L.A. or Orange County area and are interested in attending the musical, tickets for matinee and evening performances of Mamma Mia are available at scfta.org.
Well, I'm really looking forward to seeing Shai perform, so if anybody else can make it, we really hope to see you at the matinee on Sunday. So I'm not sure I'm going to do a live show at all. Probably not. Possibly in the middle of the day, Monday. I don't know. Probably won't do one. But the show will come out on Monday, not on Sunday as usual. So don't panic when it's a day late. But I've been early lately, so I think I got some credits stacked up there, right? Well, this week I was on Clockwise again, hosted by Jason Snell and Stephen Hackett. As is often the case when I'm on the show, the other guest chair was held by the awesome Micah Sargent. If you haven't ever heard Clockwise before, it's really worth checking out. It's exactly 30 minutes long, four people, four tech topics. And it's super crisp, it's on point, but it's still clever and fun and playful. So it's a really, really good show. I love listening to it. Anyway, there's a link in the show notes to Clockwise number 163, The Ultimate Dongle. I also got to be on Bart Bouchat's Let's Talk Photography podcast. I've said this before, but the main reason I don't like to be on the show is because I like listening to the show so much. But I had to give one for the team and go ahead and be on the show. Anyway, Bart, Antonio Rosario, and a new guest named Clay Daly and I talked about gifts for photographers. We did stocking stuffers, medium price gifts, and even break the bank gifts. Check out episode 38 of Let's Talk Photography at let's-talk.ie. Well, if you thought Taming the Terminal was done, you'll be surprised to find out a new episode has landed in your Chit Chat Across the Pond feed. In episode 36 of N, Bart teaches us about two cool utilities that are built into iOS 10. It's actually macOS and are available also in Linux. The first one is called Cron, which allows you to schedule scripts to run at prescribed times and intervals. The second is called Screen, which lets you launch a virtual terminal session inside the terminal. That sounds kind of head explodey, but Bart explains why you'd want to do it, and it's really clever and actually pretty easy to do. Of course, as always, the episode is available in the Chit Chat Across the Pond podcast, and the detailed show notes are over at bartbouchats.ie. Soon, we'll also have it up as part of the Taming the Terminal podcast feed as well. When the Hue Light system came out a few years ago, Steve really wanted to dip his toes into the home automation fun. We got the Hue Hub and plugged it into our router and installed the three bulbs into a few lamps. It was pretty much a party trick, changing the colors from white to red to blue to mess with each other and guests in our home. When the Sci-Fi Channel connected the TV show The Expanse to the Hue, Steve was thrilled to have something to actually do with his Hue bulbs that was something interesting. It was actually a pretty cool use. The lights change according to what's going on during the TV show. Dark and creepy scenes, bright and brightly lit scenes. He absolutely loved it. But like most people, we're getting pretty worried about IoT security. Even though we had the Hue bridge and bulbs on our completely separate dedicated router from our real computers, and even though we have NetPMP turned off, we still would rather be more secure. With iOS 10, Apple finally introduced a centralized tool for managing your IoT devices called Home. We knew that Hue had come out with a new version of their hub that was HomeKit compatible and would let us use our existing bulbs, so this seemed like the right time to dip our toes a little deeper into home automation. Now our Hue devices could play on the big girl network and we'd be super secure because of the hardware encryption. Plus, with Apple Home as the interface, we knew that we'd have a simple and easy way to configure the device. But that's not exactly how it all worked out. So let's back up and start at the beginning. Skip most of the middle gory bits, and then we're going to circle back to the end of the story. I bought Steve the new Hue Bridge as a present, and he was super excited to set it up. We fight over things like this, but it was his present, so he got to do it. He unplugged the old hub from the airport router and plugged the new hub into the Netgear X8. He opened the home app on his iPhone and tapped Add Accessory. Immediately, the home app saw his shiny new hub and asked him to scan the official HomeKit number on the bottom of the device. Boom, done. Worked perfectly. It just works. All right, now it's time to play with the bulbs. We've got the hub working. But Home said he had to go to the manufacturer's app to play with the bulbs. All right, so he launched the Hue app, and while he could still see the hub, it couldn't see any of the bulbs. Steve went off to the Googles, and he discovered that to switch hubs, you must not unplug the old hub until you've transferred over from the old hub to the new hub. Seriously, he tried to back up in the process, but it didn't work, and he got frustrated after an hour or two, and he gave up. Fast forward a couple of weeks until this couple of weeks ago, when I decided to take another run at it. After a bunch of poking and prodding and resetting, I got the two hubs to talk to each other and transfer the data from one to the other. Now, this data is merely the name of the three lights and the name of the hub. That's it. Maybe Steve's Hue user account is in there somewhere too. But the two devices blink lights back and forth at each other as though they were transferring terabytes of secret information until they finally finished. Now, the Hue app can see the new Hue hub and it knows the names of the bulbs. I was even able to blink them on and off during the setup. All right, great. Let's go back to the home app. Around this time, I discovered that once you declare a home with the home app, the Apple ID of the user who originally set it up owns the home. The owner can invite other people into the home, though, so I use Steve's home app to invite me by my Apple ID. All right, great. Except when I tap on Add Accessory, Home doesn't see the darn Hue hub. At this point, I'm like, seriously, you got to be kidding me. This is too hard. After even more Googling and fiddling around, I reset the Hue bridge by poking a paperclip into its reset button, and finally, the home app could see the bridge again. So let's just say that all of this pain and anguish was because the Hue hub transfer was problematic. I can get on board with that. We'll blame Hue. But after I successfully added the Hue to home, it came up telling me that additional setup was required, and I had to go back to the manufacturer's app from the home app. I don't even remember what voodoo I had to do over there on the Hue app, but finally and eventually I was able to go back to the home app. It now showed my home with two bulbs in default room. I tapped on rooms, changed default room's name to family room. I took a photo of it like it invited me to, and I tapped done. Home then said, could not edit room, family room. Seriously? What? Why? Why did you give me a darn field where I could change the name if you wouldn't let me change the name? Okay, fine. Default room it is. I went to rooms, tapped on one of the bulbs, and the light went off. All right, tapped it and went back on. Then for some reason, it occurred to me to force press on the light. Actually, that's probably 3D touch now that I think about it. So I 3D touched on the light. That popped up a new screen saying 100% brightness and an option to change the color or go into details. Well, details sounded like fun. In there, I found I could rename the light. And guess what else I could do? I could change the name of the room. Not under room, but under 3D touching the light bulb. All right, the only thing I can figure is that the default room is just where things land when they come into your home, and then you have to move them to a new room. So renaming default room didn't make sense, I guess. Anyway, I've spent about 4 hours on this darn thing, and I've just gotten to the point where I can turn my lights on and off with HomeKit. I can also use Siri to do it. Now, I'm hoping to finally get to spend some time actually finding out what you can do with HomeKit and figure out how to get the Apple TV to talk to it so I can control my home from outside the network. That's going to be fun, I'm sure. But I did do some searches on the Apple TV, and guess what? There's no home app on the Apple TV, so I got to go figure that out. I found a link to how to do it, but still, really? Too hard. So I really thought that using the home app from Apple to manage our home automation would make all of this nonsense easier, but it seems to me that it made it even more complicated than it was before. So now instead of one app with too many fiddly bits, I have two apps with lots more fiddly bits. If two engineers with master's degrees find that home didn't make things easier, I am not sure how normal people will ever get this stuff to work. Before I go on this particular rant, I do want to make sure to state that I have been incredibly blessed in my life in every way, and that I realize this is a petty and small problem that I feel compelled to describe to you. When it comes to ordering Apple gear, I feel like the cartoon character Ziggy. Remember him? He's the guy for whom everything seemed to go wrong. Well, if you've been listening for a long time, you'll remember when the iPhone 4 first came out. Rather than have it delivered to my house, I pre-ordered in the middle of the night, and I got up at the crack of dawn, and I stood in line outside the Apple store. I got there at 6:30 in the morning to pick up my phone that I'd pre-ordered. But while everyone who chose home delivery happily got theirs throughout the day, it took 10 hours for me to get my phone. When the iPhone 5 came out, I was smart. I chose home delivery. Even though my buddy Ron, who lives exactly 1.5 miles away in the same darn town, got his early in the morning, mine was the very last one off the truck at 6 p.m. Then there was the time I ordered the iPad Air. This is one of my favorites. I was going to wait at home anyway for my iPad Air, so my friend Diane had me order her one too to be delivered to my house. I figured I'd be the last one on the route yet again, but imagine my consternation when at 5 p.m. FedEx canceled my delivery. After having some choice words with dispatch about it, they said, you'll have to wait till the next day to get it. I ended up calling the Apple store and found out they had tons of them in stock. Seriously, if I had tried to buy day of, you know they wouldn't have had them in stock, right? But because I wanted delivery, they had them in stock. So at this point, I was so angry at FedEx, I drove over to the Apple store and I bought two of them, figuring I could return the other ones the next day. But as I drove down my street to return home, a FedEx truck was pulling away from my house. I pulled over to block the driver from getting away, jumped out of the car and asked him, "Did you just try to deliver something?" And he said, "Sure, I got these two boxes for you, the two iPads." All right, let's fast forward to the new MacBook Pros. I jumped online the instant they went on sale, and I ordered the 15-inch model. Delivery was going to be tricky, though. We were going to be in San Diego for the week, watching our grandson Forbes, returning on the afternoon of Thursday, the 17th of November. When I ordered the MacBook Pro, it said delivery would be on the 17th. So that was cutting it a little close. So I looked at the option to maybe have it delivered to my local Apple store, because that might work. But when I changed the delivery to the Apple store, it moved the delivery out an entire week, which was clearly unacceptable. I figured I'd take my chances and have it delivered on the 17th. We already know I'm last on the route, so that could work, or worst case, they'd have to bring it to me the next day, and I figured I could survive that. But remember I told you I feel like Ziggy sometimes? Guess what Apple did? They shipped it 3 days early. I couldn't believe it. For once, I was getting mine first, but I wouldn't even be there. The good news is I found out it was coming early, so I was able to redirect delivery to my local UPS customer center, and they nicely held it for me till I got back into town. And guess what time they delivered it there? 7 a.m. Seriously, 7 a.m. was how early they delivered it. So you know what's going to happen the next time I order from Apple, right? I'm going to choose to have it delivered directly to the UPS customer center because I'll be hoping I'll get it early again and not have to wait around all day. But, you know, some sort of calamity is going to occur. Maybe a fire. There'll be police activity that'll block all the streets around the customer center. I am just certain it will all go horribly wrong. Now, when Lindsay saw this story when I posted it over on Facebook, she said, "Oh, I feel bad because you were taking care of Forbes and you didn't get to play with your computer those 3 days." And I said, no, don't feel bad, because if I hadn't been playing with him, you know, it wouldn't have been delivered 3 days early. You know, something else would have gone wrong. All right. Well, anyway, I finally got my new baby when I got back home. Remember, just recently, Apple replaced a ton of stuff inside my 2013 MacBook Pro, so I'd been forced to do a clean install. Because of that, I figured I could easily enjoy the process of using Migration Assistant like everybody else. But that was a disaster. I plugged my old and my new MacBook Pros into my gigabit Ethernet switch using one of my fancy new dongles, and I launched Migration Assistant. Once I got both Macs talking to each other, I watched the timer go longer and longer and longer about how long it was going to take to move my data. I had about 600 gig worth of stuff. Anyway, it started saying 5 hours, then it went to 9, then it went to 15, and then it went to 25 hours. Now, the thing that really concerned me was not actually the timer, but it also showed me the data transfer rate. It started at 12 megabytes per second, but then it slowed to 6 megabytes per second. Now, this is transferring between two SSDs, so that should not have been the bottleneck. Gigabit is 1,000 megabits per second, and at 8 bits per byte, that's 125 megabytes per second. So why was it transferring at 5% of that speed? I hoped it was the old, you know, watch pot never boiling problem. So I left it alone for over 4 hours. I think it was actually 4.5 hours. But in that time, it only moved 120 gigabytes of data. Now, at full speed, it should have been able to move all 600 gigabytes of my data in about 80 minutes. Now, I know you never get that actual number, but still, it's not even close. Clearly, something was wrong. I thought maybe since Wi-Fi was on both Macs, maybe it wasn't using Ethernet after all. I did have the two machines sitting inches away from my fancy new Nighthawk X8 router, so even Wi-Fi should have been way faster than that. I finally bailed on the migration. I turned off Wi-Fi on both Macs, and I started it up again. Guess what Migration Assistant did? It turned Wi-Fi back on. It even told me it was going to use Wi-Fi. Okay, fine. I gave up on Migration Assistant, and I simply dragged my data from one Mac to the other, again, through this gigabit switch, and it took less than 2 hours. Then I let Migration Assistant migrate all my apps. But guess what? Every single app is asking me to either authenticate to the App Store when I launch it or enter my license keys. I'm having to configure IRC, configure Auphonic, and it's like I'm doing the whole thing all over again. Now, while this was fun and entertaining the last time, I really, really didn't want to do this again. Now, I got to say, I am really glad that I kept track of everything I had to do the last time. I've got it all in Wunderlist, so I've been going back whenever something doesn't work. I'm like, okay, I got to go figure this out, I can actually just go look them up. So, excuse me while I go get my printer working with the new Mac. This podcast is not supported by ads, but it is supported by you. If you find value in the show, please head over to podfeet.com/Patreon and sign up to pledge your support. Once a month, you'll be billed for however many NoSilicasts I produce during that month. Listener Lynn wrote in with a great question about Patreon. She asked how you get billed if you support a whole bunch of podcasts. The good news is, as she hoped, you get one consolidated bill, not a whole bunch of little tiny micropayments. I'd like to give a shout out to our newest Patreon, Jupe Brugink. Did I say that right? Jupe Brugink from the Netherlands. He's also known as Owet Grunnen on Twitter. I can't thank you enough for helping to support the show, Jupe. Now, don't forget to use the Amazon affiliate link sprinkled throughout the show notes for products you hear about on the show. You can also use the big Amazon button on the podfeet.com homepage, and anything you buy right after you click one of the links will send along a small percentage to support the show, and it won't cost you a dime. Last week, I did an article entitled 3D Touch is More Useful Than I Thought, and the response to it has been great. A whole bunch of people have written in to tell me about even cooler stuff I didn't know 3D Touch could do. Here's a couple of them. Steve Feinstein explained that on the iPhone, you can use 3D Touch to control the cursor in text entry. So you just press on the keyboard. You do the 3D Touch right on the keyboard when you're in a typing field. This is spectacular. I never knew it could do this, and it's going to reduce a huge bit of friction for me. I don't know about you, but sometimes I just leave typos in because it's so tedious to try to get the cursor in just the right spot while your finger is covering up the right spot. In this way, your finger's really far from where you are, and it just works really well. By the way, if you're frustrated by this on the iPad, which doesn't have 3D Touch, holding down two fingers on the virtual keyboard will give you the same cursor control. I use that all the time. Steve went on to explain that you can use 3D Touch to open the task switcher by pressing on the left side of the screen. I've tried this and it's a little bit hard to do, but if you like it, it works well, especially if your home button doesn't work or you don't want to use the home button. Anyway, he said that these two uses of 3D Touch were enough for him to upgrade from a 6 to a 6S. Next up, my daughter Lindsay commented in our Facebook group, podfeet.com/Facebook, after I posted the article there. She wrote, I found another good use. I had an unknown contact call me, and when I went to add them to my contacts directly from the missed calls list, I could not see the option to add them as a contact. Turns out that you have to have, or that you actually can use 3D Touch on the phone number, and then it will give you the create new contact option. Who knew? Now, I never would have thought to use 3D Touch in that case, so I think her lesson is, when in doubt, 3D Touch. When I was on the Clockwise podcast, Micah Sargent asked us to talk about whether we use 3D Touch. It was like he walked into my favorite subject right now. Anyway, in the middle of the discussion, Jason Snell mentioned that he too has trouble triggering the jiggly icon dance. You know, the thing where you can delete your icons or move them around. He has the same problem that now he has 3D Touch. He can't get them to move. Well, the guys on the show explained that you have to simply rest your finger on an icon. So it's a long touch, but not a press. And then they'll start to jiggle. Sure enough, that worked. But I thought that was really weird that there's 3D touch that does one thing. There's this long touch that you're not actually pressing. That does something else. If you press kind of hard, but not really hard, it fuzzes out all the other stuff and just highlights the thing that you're holding, which has no value whatsoever. But it's this weird intermediate thing. Anyway, now with a long touch, I can successfully delete and move around my icons. Then later on Twitter, Ryan Warner, also known as Solar Walker, he explained that you can adjust the sensitivity of 3D touch by going to Settings, General, Accessibility, 3D Touch. That might be fun to dig in there and see if you can get it to do what you want it to do. On Clockwise, I said that while 3D Touch is super useful for those apps that are on my home screen, I use Spotlight to search for any app that isn't on the home screen. That means I wouldn't be able to use 3D Touch on any of them. Well, Ryan and also Mark Gordon and Jonathan Alba all wrote in to explain that you can use 3D Touch on apps when Spotlight reveals them to you. So you pull down, type in the name of what you're looking for, and it shows you the app you're looking for due to 3D Touch right then, and you get 3D Touch. How cool is that? So anyway, thanks to everyone for all the great tips. Let's keep going and take a look at the rest of the more interesting implementations I found of 3D Touch. Well, I have three banking apps on my iPhone, and they had very different ideas of what would be useful to do with 3D Touch. The first one let me jump right to transferring money, pay people, pay bills, or do an electronic deposit. I thought that was a great list of the most common things I do in online banking. The second one, though, only revealed close-by ATMs and nothing else. Kind of lame. But my credit union was the biggest fail with no actions at all. So your mileage may vary on how useful 3D Touch is with you, with your bank, but it's worth checking out to see if they did a good job. I'm not a big Instagram user, but if you are, you'll be glad to know that you can do a new post, view activity, search, or look at your direct messages with 3D Touch. Netflix works much like the Pocket Cast app that I talked about last week for podcasts. You can see your list, trending now, or simply continue watching your last viewed show. Series watching is probably the main fun of Netflix, so that last option is exactly what I would actually want. Now, I'm betting you have a lot of cloud services these days, so let's flip through these together to see what they reveal. iCloud Drive gave me the option to search or open one of the last three things I'd uploaded. Google Drive was only slightly more interesting. It showed search and the last two most recently opened files, but also gave me the option to upload photos. And why just photos, though? What about other stuff? Anyway, Dropbox kind of split the difference with search and upload a single photo, again, photos, not other kinds of documents, and then they added in the option to view offline photos. But then they took it up a notch and gave a widget option that would let you scan a document, upload photos, and create files. Now, I'm surprised nobody mentioned after the first article that I had been ignoring the whole widgets thing in 3D Touch. I hadn't even mentioned it till now. I have to confess that it wasn't until the guys in Clockwise started talking about widgets that I realized I'd just ignored them because I didn't really get what they did. For the two other people who aren't on the widget bandwagon yet, if you pull down from the top of the iPhone screen, you get your notifications first, but if you swipe from left to right on the screen, you get to widgets. This can easily get messy if you add too many widgets, and I kind of think it's a lot of swiping, so you're down, right, I don't know, it's a lot of swiping. I also have trouble figuring out where widgets are versus control center stuff. I get kind of confused. This may work great for you, though, so don't let my confusion keep you from experimenting with widgets inside 3D Touch. Slack lets you search messages, files, channels, or direct messages. Personally, I haven't found a big use case for Slack yet in my daily life, so I don't know if those are compelling options, but they sound pretty cool. Now, I'm as addicted to Starbucks as they want me to be. And their 3D Touch implementation only adds to that addiction. With 3D Touch, you can choose to pay, and it will pop up the barcode of your Starbucks card. Or you can reload the card with more money right there at your fingertips. You can find new stores and even order right from the app. Brilliant. I'm telling you, Starbucks, they're really good at this stuff. Well, if you like to use your iPhone as a scanner, you might like Scanner Pro from Riedel. With 3D Touch, you can immediately launch a new scan. That seems pretty useful. Or you can create a scan from an existing photo. That doesn't seem to be like something I'd need like right at my fingertips. People seem to have fallen in love with the Apple Notes app lately. You can view your latest note, create a new note, a new checklist, add a new photo, or create a new sketch, all with 3D Touch. Now, Stocks, for some reason, seems to have a permanent home on the iPhone. And if you like it, you'll be glad to know you can check your top three stocks at the press of your finger. I recently did an article about the often forgotten Reminders app. 3D Touch lets you add a reminder to four different possible lists. These are not the top four. They're not the most recent four. They just appear to be a random list of a set of four lists from what I was able to figure out. Below that, it shows you upcoming items in your reminders that are time-based. I'm not entirely sure what algorithm they use to show you these reminders, though. Once it showed me two items that were overdue. Another time it showed me something due the same day, but it didn't show me something that was due in 2 days. I'm not sure 3D Touch is something on which you'd want to rely for time-based reminders. A few years ago, Apple added within the Health app the ability to create and add information to a medical ID. You can give your full name, birth date, height, weight, emergency contacts, and the relationship to you, along with blood type, preference for organ donation, medical conditions, medications, and allergies. It's a great thing to do for yourself, and if you find someone in medical distress and they have an iPhone, you can launch right into Medical ID from the Health app to give them assistance. It might seem a bit intrusive to use their fingerprint to unlock their phone, but I can tell you, if I'm unconscious on the side of the road, please open Medical ID on my phone. If you can figure out the swipe combinations, there is a way to get to Medical ID without unlocking the phone, and I did get it to come up once, but I was not able to crack the code on how to find it a second time. I love the app iThoughts for making mind maps on the Mac and on iOS. With 3D Touch, I can jump to recents, favorites, and create a quick thought or generate a new mind map. I didn't know what a quick thought was, so I created one with 3D Touch. It's kind of interesting. They have a generic map entitled Quick Thoughts with a node called Inbox, and then a new node is highlighted ready for you to add your quick thought. I really should read manuals, you know. I bet that does something cool if I open it on another device. IMDb is a favorite of many people for learning about movies and actors. With 3D Touch, you can do a quick search or look for showtimes. I like to use IMDb for showtimes and then buy tickets from them because I really find the free service of IMDb so valuable, I want them to stay in business. I don't often use Skype on iOS, but if I did, their 3D Touch implementation would be pretty useful. You can search Skype, go right to the dial pad to dial a number, start a text chat, or start a new video call. What else would you want? Now, you know I love Cloak as my VPN of choice. The main reason I love it is because, like 98% of the time, it's set it and forget it. When I connect to an untrusted network, Cloak protects my traffic automatically. When I connect to a trusted network, it doesn't get in my way. Now, I said 98% of the time it works flawlessly, so for that 2% where it gets persnickety, 3D Touch lets me toggle it on or off with one press of the button. Perfect use for 3D Touch. Now, I'm not a big Snapseed user for some reason. It never seems to want to do what I want to do with my photos, but I know George from Tulsa swears by it. With 3D Touch, you can paste an image, open the latest image, use the camera to bring an image into Snapseed, and finally, open from device. Now, the name of that last one confused me, as much as the Snapseed interface always does. I tested it out, and it simply means to open a photo from your library. Why didn't they just say that? If you have actual weather where you live, you might like Wonderground's 3D Touch implementation. You can see the weather in your current location, a saved location, view a weather map, or see the last 6 hours of precipitation. Again, you have to have actual weather for this to be interesting. I don't think there's anything geeks like better than testing their internet speed. The common standard is to go to speakeasy.net/speedtest, but it uses Flash, so you can't use it on iOS. The good news is that the developers of that speed test, a company called Ookla, have a fabulous iOS app called simply Speed Test. With 3D Touch, you can immediately take a speed test, way easier than using the website. You can also view your previous results acquired via the iOS app using 3D Touch. Now, I probably should have lumped all the chat apps together, but let's take a look now at WhatsApp. The SMR podcast guys love WhatsApp along with millions of other people. But oddly, I have no other friends who use it other than the SMR podcast guys. If you use it with 3D Touch, you can go to start messages, take a photo or video, start a new chat, or do a search. I would think jumping into a recent conversation or the top people I chat with might be a little more useful. Yelp has a lot of options in 3D Touch. The widget portion has the good stuff. You can search generically or go right to restaurants, coffee and tea, or bars. Not that I would condone that sort of activity, of course. They also let you see activity, which seems to be a stream of information from people I don't know about restaurants in random locations where I'm not. Anyway, you can add a photo or a video or check in there too. YouTube has pretty obvious options in 3D Touch. You can create a video right on the spot, go to your subscriptions, or search. Pretty standard, but useful. Hey, look, another messaging app. Facebook Messenger lets you write a new message, talk to one of two people. Not sure how they choose those two people. For me, it's Lindsay and Steve, but that's not who I had talked to most recently when I checked it. You can also see your Messenger code. I have no idea what this code is. Chose my profile picture with dots and dashes encircling me, sort of like a circular barcode. I'm sure it's useful for something, but honestly, I've never seen it before. iBooks lets you jump right into the latest two books you're reading, or you can search for a new book. I have an app that I think sounds really cool, but I never think to use it. It's called Just Press Record. The name is perfect. You simply press record, so 3D Touch gives you a quick way to start recording. That's if launching the app and touching the single button is too hard for you. I think it'll show you recent recordings as well, because it complained that I hadn't made any recordings yet today. By the way, Just Press Record is an Apple Watch app, which is why I got it in the first place. Twitter is all about instant gratification. With 3D Touch, you can do a new tweet or a new direct message, but nothing else. American Airlines really only gave 3D Touch lip service, like they paid an intern to do it or something, because the only thing you can do is view terminal maps. How about check my flight status? Or heck, if that's too hard, how about check any flight status? Come on, guys, you could do better than that. Now, I've told you about the app Together from Reinvented Software. I use it as a replacement for Evernote, so pretty much anything I want to remember is inside this app for the Mac and iOS. With 3D Touch, you can add a new note, look at your inbox, check favorites, or create a new rich text document. Perfect use of 3D Touch. Flickr lets you go straight to search, see your notifications, check out your feed, or take a photo directly within the app. Now, I save Flickr for my best of the best of the best sir photos, so I probably wouldn't use that last option to just take a photo with the Flickr app, but it's cool they've added that in if that's how you use it. I talked about Google Drive last week, but Google also has separate iOS apps. I don't usually access documents from my iPhone, but Google Sheets lets you create a new document from a template, or access the last couple of documents you've opened, all with 3D Touch. As annoying as it is to diet, the app Lose It is a pretty good way to keep track of your input and output. I used it to lose 10 pounds a few years ago, so I'm a fan. With 3D Touch, you can jump directly into recording your weight, which is strangely difficult to find in the app, so this is actually pretty cool that it can do that. From 3D Touch, you can also log exercise, log food, or scan a barcode to record your food intake. It also lets you start entering data into breakfast, lunch, dinner, or a snack. Now, I didn't want to end on a note talking about dieting, so how about a really fun one? If you swipe up on the iPhone to get to the control center, you can see the ever-important flashlight app. I use it all the time. I know Steve Jobs said we didn't need any more flashlight apps, and that was probably because they had these big plans for the 3D Touch implementation. Press and hold on 3D Touch, and you can choose between low light, medium, and bright light. See? I told you this was a good one. Well, also in Control Center is the timer, and 3D Touch lets you instantly create a 1 hour, 20-minute, 5-minute, or 1-minute timer. I mentioned last week the 3D Touch on the camera icon lets you immediately jump to a specific mode like selfie, video, slow-mo, or a regular photo. Well, those same features exist inside Control Center. To be honest, this is the most reliable way for me to quickly get into the camera. I'm glad Apple gave us so many ways so we can use the one that works for us. Now, this hasn't been an exhaustive list. Maybe it's exhausting, but it hasn't been an exhaustive list of all apps that use 3D Touch. But I hope it was enough to help you get excited about it and maybe remember to give it a try on your favorite apps. I've been using a late 2013 MacBook Pro to produce the podcast for the last 3 years. Before that, I used an early 2011 MacBook Pro. I decided to upgrade to the 2016 Touch Bar enabled MacBook Pro, and I chose the 15-inch quad-core 2.6 gigahertz i7 with 16 gigabytes of RAM and a 2 terabyte SSD. Now, I was going to go 1 terabyte, but Steve said, "No, I'll go for the 2 terabytes." I'm pretty excited I did because I was able to bring my photos back online. Anyway, I didn't choose quite the top of the line. It's just one button click short. For another several hundred dollars, I could have gotten a 0.1 gigahertz uptick in processor and a bump up in the discrete graphics. Now I'm trying to prove to you that I have self-control. Well, people have been losing their ever-loving minds about several things on this new design. They're annoyed about the keyboard, the 16 gigabyte memory limitation, and the ports. Now, I already talked about the ports last week, and I think they're pretty awesome. So let's start talking about some of the other stuff. Let's start first with talking about the keyboard. When Apple came out with the 12-inch MacBook, they announced a new butterfly switch design to the keyboard. Many people hated it because it doesn't have a lot of travel. I didn't love it, but I bought the MacBook because of how thin and light it is, and the sacrifice of a good keyboard was worth it to me. I find that I do make more typos on it, but I still love the device, and it's acceptable. When Apple announced the new MacBook Pros, they said it was version 2 of the butterfly switch design. I can say categorically that it is a significant design improvement over the 12-inch MacBook keyboard. Now, I can't say whether you'll like it or not, but it feels like a real keyboard to me. The one thing I don't like about it is it's actually kind of loud. It's not clicky, it's kind of a lower frequency, kind of thumpy sound. It's not enough to bother someone in a normal work environment, but it makes it really hard to stealthily type while recording a podcast. I may have to start paying attention to the people on the shows I'm on instead. All right, let's switch gears and talk about speed. My previous MacBook Pro was the late 2013 with a 2.2 gigahertz i7 Haswell with 16 gigabytes of RAM. Well, like I said, the new one is 2.6 gigahertz, so 2.2 to 2.6, and it's an i7 also, but it's a Skylake instead of a Haswell. They both have 16 gigabytes of RAM. Now, I'm not a chip junkie, except maybe the potato chip variety, but I figure Skylake should be better than Haswell, right? And it's got that extra 0.4 gigahertz in clock speed, so this thing should really scream. Well, the most processor-intensive activity I do is to create videos for Don McAllister using ScreenFlow. While creating the video, it doesn't really demand too much of the processor. In fact, I tested out using ScreenFlow on the 12-inch MacBook, and it isn't bad at all. The longer and bigger the file gets, it does start to slow down. But the big time problem is what it takes to render a file when the production is completed. For example, the 12-inch MacBook takes about twice as long with its little tiny Core M processor than the 2013 MacBook Pro. So in order to test this, I opened a 17-gigabyte, 45-minute ScreenFlow project on the 2013 and 2016 MacBook Pros. Or am I supposed to be saying MacBooks Pro? I'm not sure. Anyway, I made sure no other applications were running, and I asked both of them to render an iPad, an M4V version of the video. The new Mac finished in 10 minutes and 38 seconds, and the old Mac finished in 11 minutes and 22 seconds. Now, while the 2016 Mac is about 7% faster, that's only a 44-second difference. I'm not in that much of a hurry. So while these were running, I took a look at the memory and CPU usage, and the new MacBook Pro was definitely not hard-pressed on this task. It was using 10.5 gigabytes of app memory, it didn't swap to disk at all, and the processor was running at 350%, so I still had 50% left out of the four cores. I could have done other things and probably not slowed the test down at all. Now, I know this isn't a full-length feature film I'm working on here, but it was really interesting to me that the new machine was not really that much faster than the old one. Next, I run the Blackmagic speed test app on the SSDs on the two machines. Apple claims the new SSD is twice as fast as the old ones, and at least with my speed test, that is absolutely true. While both SSDs met all of the video encoding standards that Blackmagic checks for, both read and write speeds on the 2016 were more than double the speed of the 2013 MacBook Pro. On reads, it was 2.27 times as fast. I think it could be even faster, though, because it actually pegged the meters. I got a screenshot at 1955 megabytes per second write and 1940 megabytes per second read, but I definitely saw that read hit 2000, which is the highest that meter can go. Now, I plan to do more speed tests over time, so if you think of something you'd like me to try, let me know. I'm going to install Final Cut Pro 10 on the new machine and have Steve do some speed tests between the MacBook Pro and his 2012 27-inch iMac. That should be fun to watch. All right, let's cleanse our palate and talk about the Touch Bar. I think it's worth getting this device if only for Touch ID. It's magical to unlock your Mac with a fingerprint. Now, I've got an Apple Watch and I can unlock with the Apple Watch, but the fingerprint is actually faster. Whenever it's available as an option, Touch Bar lights up with a little bouncing arrow pointing at it to tell you it's waiting for you. It's magical to open 1Password with your finger. It's magical to unlock system prefs with the tap of your finger. It's positively awesome. I love it. Now, there is a new system pref just for Touch ID. In there, much like with iOS, you can add fingerprints, but you also get a checkbox to decide whether to use it to unlock your Mac, use it for Apple Pay, and whether to enable it for iTunes and the App Store. So remember how I'm having to re-enter a lot of app information because of how I migrated my machine? Well, oddly, every single app from the Mac App Store is making me re-authenticate, and it's not letting me use Touch ID for it, even though I have that checkbox ticked. I know that's going to stop after a while, but come on, it ticks me off. See what I did there? All right, if you're an emoji fan, Touch Bar is going to delight you. Whenever you're typing somewhere in a typing field, there's a little smiley face waiting for you. Tap that, and then you can slide right and left through all of the emojis. They just go flying by. It's really, really fun. By default, it shows you the most recently used. It designates that with a little clock icon, but there's a button so you can toggle through the types of emojis like, you know, faces, animals, food, sports, and more. They're bright and colorful, and they make it super fun and easy to choose just that right emotion you're looking for. Now, my main use of the function keys, the physical ones in the past, was to turn volume up and down and change the screen brightness. Those two work well on Touch Bar, but it's actually two taps to do either one of those. By default, even in the Finder, Apple chose to collapse the functions way over on the right, often leaving the middle of Touch Bar blank. If you tap the chevron, the normal functions slide out, and then you can go tap, tap, tap up and down on the controls. If you don't tap the chevron and instead tap on the audio or screen brightness button, you get a slider that's pretty nice for exact control. I kind of like that better. Either way, it's two taps at least where it used to be one. It's a minor nit, but the good news is that they could change this if they wanted to. I put apple.com/feedback as a bookmark in Safari, so it's easy for me to suggest improvements right when I think of them, and I'm sure they really appreciate it. Oh, I should point out that if you care about the brightness of the backlit keys, you can also do that with Touch Bar in the same place. But again, it's two touches. Touch ID is on the far right of the Touch Bar, and it's just a smidge to the left of it is the Siri button. Well, I hit Siri all the time when I'm trying to hit the delete key that's right below it. Again, they could move it over a bit so it's not accidentally hit. On the left side is the escape key, and oddly, they slid it to the right a bit. It looks like it's to make it look symmetrical with the right side, which is kind of silly. The good news is that if you only slightly catch the edge of the escape key, it triggers, which I think is sort of what's happening over on the right with the Siri key. But they must have known that people's muscle memory would make them miss the escape key, and that's why they worked it that way. The Safari integration with Touch Bar is interesting. If you have multiple tabs open, you can see the tabs in Touch Bar. They're wee tiny and short, right? And if the top bar of the website isn't very colorful, they're kind of hard to tell apart. Luckily, the NoSilicast logo is super easy to see in Touch Bar, so that's all that really matters. If you put your cursor in the URL field, I use Command-L to do that, Touch Bar knows you want to go to a new site, so it offers you buttons for your bookmark bar favorites. If your favorites have good fave icons, the little image, that's a little image to the left of the URL, you know, like an adorable pair of bare feet. If they're colorful like that, it's very easy to tap and go right in. I'm not sure it's any easier than tapping with a trackpad on screen, but it's still kind of fun. So far, Google hasn't implemented Touch Bar support for Chrome, but I bet they'll have some fun with it when they do. Photos brings up a slider in Touch Bar so you can flip through your photos. You can just slide back and forth. Whee! It's really fun. If you edit a photo, you can dive down into the menus for light, color, cropping, etc. right within Touch Bar. Again, I'm not sure it's easier than looking on screen when you go messing around with that, so it might be a novelty item. I'm not sure that's going to be useful. On iOS, when you're typing, you get a little bar with word suggestions. I forget what they call that. And if you're not a speed typist, those can come in really handy. If you like them, you're going to be glad to know that you get them with Touch Bar and the new MacBook Pros as well. I taught myself to touch type when I was a little kid, so I have to actually slow down to use it on Touch Bar on the Mac. But I sure like it on iOS. I type fast enough on the Mac that Touch Bar doesn't even update most of the time I'm typing. Now, I also might put Touch Bar in the beta category. At one point, I had my Touch Bar get stuck with a Photos logo on it with a slider for a video, but I was already over in Safari at the time. I'm sure they get that sorted over time. And it has only messed up once in about, I don't know, how long has it been? Like 4 or 5 days? 3 days? 4 days. Anyway. All right. I'm looking forward to more discovery with Touch Bar over time, but let's move on to the new trackpad. I'm a huge fan of the external Force Touch Magic trackpad and the one on the 12-inch MacBook. The one in the 15-inch MacBook Pro is only slightly smaller than the Magic trackpad. It's actually bigger than an iPhone 7. It's crazy big. So I love the non-mechanical click of the trackpad, but it has a couple of little bugs to be worked out. For example, I like to enable three-finger drag on my trackpad, but it doesn't work all the time on the Touch Bar Mac. Now, if you're confused about this three-finger drag thing, what I'm talking about, they've really hidden it ever since El Capitan. It's in System Preferences, Accessibility, Mouse and Trackpad, Trackpad Options, Enable Dragging, and then pull down to three-finger drag. That's six levels deep, guys. That's what you have to do to get that. Anyway, you have to really want to use three fingers to drag your windows around if you're going to have to work that hard. So I'm also having a couple of errant trackpad clicks from time to time. Now, it's not super often like in the old days with early trackpads, but they need to do maybe a bit more work on their palm rejection with this model. Since it's all fake clicking, I suspect this is a software fix. Now, I care a lot about the size and weight of my devices. The 15-inch 2016 MacBook Pro weighs in at only 4.02 pounds or 1.82 kilograms. Now, you know if Steve Jobs was alive, that would be 4.0, don't you? 4.02, really? He would have made him get rid of that last 0.02. Anyway, that's 0.44 pounds lighter than my 2013 and 1.58 pounds less than my 2011. That means the 2016 weighs 80% of what the 2011 weighed and 90% of what the 2013 weighed. If I hold the 2016 and the 2011 at the same time, you can totally tell the difference. But the little bit of drop between the 2013 and the 2011, the 0.44 pounds, it isn't really that noticeable. But I have to tell you, the volume of the box itself of the entire laptop is really noticeable. The 2016 is only 81% the volume of the 2013 and 73% of the volume of the 2011. I know that's a lot of numbers I've been throwing around, so sorry about that. But leave it to say that the new MacBook Pro is really thin and svelte. That is, until I pick up my 12-inch MacBook and then it feels like a tank. That sweet little Mac weighs in at a diminutive 2.03 pounds. Again, with the 0.03, right? Anyway, I think once the novelty wears off with the new 15-inch MacBook Pro, the 12-inch MacBook will continue to be my traveling Mac. Now, one thing I was hoping for with the new MacBook Pro was that the distance from the front edge of the laptop to the beginning of the keys would be just a bit shorter. I didn't get my wish. With the older MacBook Pros and the new 15-inch, that distance is just far enough that my watch band either rests on top of the case, making me hear this kind of scratching around of the clasp, or I can hold it just barely off the case, which means it's pulling on my wrist. With my old laptop, I got in the habit of simply taking off my watch anytime I was typing. Now, one of my favorite things about the 12-inch MacBook was that it is small enough that I don't have to take off my watch. Oh, well. It was a nice dream that they would fix that. Now, I usually like to end reviews with a bottom line, but I think it's too soon for that. I think I can say that if you have a fairly recent MacBook Pro with an SSD and you're not rolling around in extra cash, put more money into your retirement savings, put money into your kids' college fund, and wait a while until Intel, or maybe Apple, comes up with some faster chips that really make a big difference in speed. I'm sure I'll have enough thoughts in the next week on the new Touch Bar MacBook Pros. I'll have more thoughts on that. Wait, is it MacBook Pro or MacBooks Pro? Well, that's going to wind us up for this week. Do not forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions. You can email me at allison@podfee.com and follow me on Twitter at Podfee. Now, remember, everything good starts with podfee.com/something. We've got podfee.com/Patreon, podfee.com/Facebook, podfee.com/Google+, podfee.com/Amazon. And if you want to join in the fun of the live show, normally you can head over to podfee.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time, except not next week. So you got to wait 2 weeks for that. And when you do, join the friendly and enthusiastic Nocilla Castaways. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.